Welcome to the iCoder podcast with Ian McDuff.
Okay, hello. Hello once again, dear listeners, and welcome to this iCoder podcast. I'm Ian McDuff and still speaking with you from Wellington in Aotearoa, New Zealand. In this conversation, I'm delighted to be joined by two Canadian colleagues, Colm Branigan and Mark Bala. Colm is a fellow of the Chartered Institute of Arbitrators in the UK and holds the advanced designation of Chartered Med Arbitrator through the ADR Institute of Canada. He's also been a full-time ADR practitioner for over 25 years. Colm is a pioneer in the development of online dispute resolution and MedArb processes and provides ODR and MedArb training through the Canadian Collaborative for Engagement and Conflict Management. I might come back to that one because I think you're both involved in that, aren't you?
Yes.
Colm has been a part-time instructor teaching ADR at the Faculty of Law at Queen's and at Humber College. Mark is a mediator, arbitrator, writer, and professor based in Toronto and practices online. Mark is now on the faculty of Osgoode Hall Law School and also faculty at York University Certificate in Dispute Resolution and the Canadian Collaborative for Engagement and Conflict Management, which is new to me. Mark is also widely published and has had a number of speaking engagements at conferences across the nation. His first book, The Art of Role-Play and Dispute Resolution Training, was released in 2020, and Colm and Mark together have recently published ODR Yesterday, Today and Tomorrow, to which we'll return in a moment. Mark is an original member of Ontario's first online tribunal, where he's mediated and adjudicated cases since 2017. However, Mark wishes to make clear he's here today in his personal capacity and not speaking on behalf of the Condominium Authority Tribunal. And Mark represents the Province of Ontario and the Board of Directors and the ADR Institute of Canada. Gentlemen, thank you for taking the time and agreeing to join the podcast series. It's really good to see you.
Well, thank you for having us.
But the audience will only be able to hear your dulcet tones. And hopefully, over time, we'll pick up the differences in your voices so they can see. Well, I may say who is speaking. Mm-hmm. But thanks for joining me. And what I'd like to do is to start off the conversation about your book. And while this is not part of the promotional tour, it could almost turn into that. ODR Yesterday, Today and Tomorrow, published last year with a foreword by Colin Rule, who is known to everybody on the planet, I think. What prompted the book? What brought you guys together to produce the book?
Well, that's a good question. Actually, it was Mark's idea. Over the years, we've written short pieces, and you know, back in the 2003, I did an LLM in ADR and wrote my major paper thesis on it. And that was, you know, a wee bit early in Canada. And then we did some podcasts. Mark and I both are friends, and we collaborate a fair amount. We also compete, which is kind of interesting. But one day Mark asked me, chapter had been in the CCH ADR manual for years, but never updated. I think updated in 2007 or 8 or something. One day Mark just suggested, hey, why don't we take that? And he had just finished his LLM in record speed, I might add. And he suggested, why don't we try and just put them together? In a way that's really a collection of writing, just kind of looking back, and you know, we've had some great comments, some not so great comments, and you know, we deliberately decided not to try and edit it into one style. We wanted it to be our voices and continue on that way. And I let Mark add to that if he'd like to.
Sure. Well, certainly. Thank you. Well, here in Canada, with the COVID pandemic hitting in March 2020, a lot of our courts closed, a lot of our administrative tribunals closed. And in terms of private practice dispute resolution, there were a number of practitioners that had full calendars, but no way of being able to proceed with their in-person processes. Mm-hmm. So what we had found here in our market was there was a bit of a scramble amongst practitioners to move online so that they could actually fulfill their responsibilities to their clients and take advantage of the opportunities to mediate, especially that were arising because you couldn't proceed with an adversarial process through our public justice system. And for both Colm and I, it was kind of interesting because I remember going to conferences, you know, 5-6 years ago with Colm speaking and raising my hand and asking a question about ODR and feeling evil eyes around the room looking at me. And in 2019, I gave a presentation at the ADR Institute of Ontario's conference called Arbitrating Online in 2019, Catch Up or Get Left Behind. And while several in the audience were amused, nobody felt the need to catch up out of concern of being left behind. Then March 2020 hit, and a lot of people were very concerned about being left behind.
Yeah.
And what we had found was that there are some colleagues who were very critical and dismissive of ODR just a few months ago, now coming and parading around in our market as though they were experts. So that in some way gave me a little bit of motivation to look back and talking to Colm and thinking about the various ODR related presentations and podcasts and papers and research that we've done over the years. I thought not only would it be an interesting time for us to look back on those, but also just to help demonstrate to colleagues that this isn't something that's new. One of the big concerns in our market that arose in March 2020 or thereabouts was this feeling that all of a sudden ODR is this brand new way of mediating disputes. Mm-hmm. Well, my common starting presentation or lecture on ODR starts off with showing people a copy of a floppy disk and referring to the mid-90s when all of this really started. And Colm was doing his research at the turn of the century. So I thought it was important for us to kind of reiterate and let people know that ODR isn't something that's brand new. It's been around for a very long period of time. We just had an opportunity at that time to get more people familiar with it. In terms of when the book actually came out, it was a very interesting time because we were easing the restrictions in Canada. And there were a lot of debates around how much should we go back in person, how much should we stay online. So it was a very interesting time for us to take a look at, you know, the past of the 90s, 2000s, 25 years of ODR, the present, what we're looking at in Canada, now that people who were so hesitant have been exposed to online platforms and the efficiencies, and also a look towards the future of what's going to come.
Yeah, I think that's
been your, Colm, go ahead.
No, I was going to say basically the same experience. You know, people had to go online, and I think that's really the key here. Once people saw it work, then they're willing to look at it in a different way. And thinking about it today, I just looked up a couple of old quotes because I thought, so ODR in Canada getting a boost. Sounds great. That was in the law time, December 8, 2008. Nothing happened after that. And then we have another one, move towards online dispute resolution, gather steam. Wow, law times 2:15. Jump ahead 5 years, and they were right.
Yeah. Has it been your experience that as the restrictions have eased, people, mediators, arbitrators, can go back into face-to-face? Have you any sense at all whether they are maintaining an online practice or have rushed with great relief back into the office?
My experience has been a number of the legal representatives who I've worked with have found that it's so much more convenient for them to participate online, so prefer it. They don't want to go through the hassle of having to travel. They prefer some of the technology leverages that we have to be able to get access to information on the go from the comfort of their office or their home. So while there have been some practitioners that tend to prefer online because that's what they're comfortable with and, you know, maybe haven't gotten as comfortable performing their services online, the vast majority that I deal with are very comfortable online and push to stay there. There's been a debate here about should the cost of in-person services increase post-pandemic. And I'm one of the believers that, yes, it should, because of the additional cost for travel, for of time, even for food in some circumstances, in getting everybody together in person. Mm-hmm. Colin, what do you think?
Yeah, I think more or less the same. Vast majority of the lawyers I deal with, and in most of my cases, and there's lawyers on both sides, so it's more civil justice than community or group work. I find that most of them will stay online, but I think what we'll see is maybe a greater use of kind of hybrid approaches, part online, part offline. I think we'll also see people becoming more aware of the flexibility of, for example, scheduling, breaking mediations up, things that are very difficult to do in person. So more or less, I mean, I've had, I think, one person ask me to do something in person, and I said, well, I'm not really keen on it. And they go, said, okay, we'll do it online. And it is cost. I live a good hour outside of Toronto on a good day. And so for me to go in is, even by train, is inconvenient. And so I agree with Mark in terms of, I've actually increased my rates if it's in person. And that, I think, will have provide a disincentive to do that. Yeah. So you know, I really have no intention of going back to anything resembling a full-time in-person type of practice. And I think that's where lawyers are, especially younger lawyers, but lawyers in general.
Has there been any pressure from lawyers? And I'm aware of this from a slightly different context to which I may return, but pressure from lawyers to return to the face-to-face context, given that, you know, while the profession is changing, there will be many in the profession who are still not happy with the technology or would rather have a probably even a greater sense of control by being part of a face-to-face process.
Well, one piece that I've picked up on is at the earlier stages of the pandemic, when everybody was participating from their own location, the lawyers I was working with had less control over their client because their client was appearing on one screen, they were appearing on the other. They weren't able to give their client a nudge to be able to reel them in, so to speak. What I found the trend has become is the lawyers that I work with tend to prefer to have their clients with them now. So they often participate like in a boardroom together in their office. And I feel that they like that because they're able to restore the in-person communication with their client. But I find that most of the lawyers that I deal with prefer interacting with the opposing parties online. What have you thought, Colin?
Yeah, I think that that's true. Although the point that Ian's making is a good one. And although we're finding, at least the vast majority of practitioners, we deal with both ADR and law practitioners are probably going to stay online. Our superior courts issued a practice direction, I think without a lot of consultation with the profession, that essentially mandated, it was an opt-out rather than an opt-in for things like examinations for discovery, even mandatory mediations in Toronto, Ottawa, and Windsor, where we have it, which was unexpected. And I think has caused a lot of pushback. People are still moving, are saying, let's do it online. But it was interesting that came out. And indeed, as in most of, I think, the world that are where ODR has been looked at, and if this really is ODR, a virtual ODR type approach, you know, I think we have, always will have a pushback. People won't do things unless they have to. And they don't see the benefits. I mean, I remember the first time I spoke about it, it was titled, you know, Online Dispute Resolution, Heaven or Hal. I was trying to be funny, but, you know, 2001, but wasn't perceived as funny. Today, I think we get a better reception. And I think people are seeing the value in it. But I don't think it's either or. Yeah. And I think we have to let our clients do that as well.
This is almost re-traumatizing me because it reminds me of the conversations I had when I've now 40 years ago when I came back from Hawaii with freshly minted mediation enthusiasm and talked to the legal profession about mediation and how, you know, what wonders this was going to bring to the world. And basically I was told never to darken their door again. And this was a shocking thing that would never take off. And what a stupid idea, until lawyers suddenly discovered that their cases were disappearing to mediation, or and cases that had sat on their files for 5 years and they hadn't done anything. But that which seems to be impossible turns out to be imperative after not too long. But the thing it reminds me also, I've been involved in an initiative which you may have come across the last couple of years, which is the Mediators Green Pledge, which coincided with the pandemic. And we've got something like 700 signatories around the world, well, pledging in as much as is possible to green their mediation practices. And what I found interesting and slightly disheartening is the number of mediators who signed up to that. And some of them I've seen on LinkedIn, once the restrictions came off, saying, yes, we can fly again, off we go, and, you know, showing pictures of them, you know, flying out of the country and pictures from the aircraft window. And there are a couple in particular who seem to be about the most peripatetic mediators I've ever come across. So ODR that you've been talking about, in part, it was because of the circumstances of the pandemic. To what extent is it your sense that it has become or can become embedded in the psyche of the legal profession, the courts? And here, this is not just ODR, this is a matter of what happened in the pandemic, migrating our practices, our ordinary practices into the digital space, but actually saying there's a digital world which can make a significant difference to the way in which we work and enhance access to justice.
Well, Mark signed the pledge. He can go ahead. I have never got around to this.
I signed the pledge. There's an arbitration one I signed as well. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I have it in my email signature. And one of the pieces I'd been pushing for so long was electronic submissions, because the amount of paper that would be wasted on what some people call mediation briefs, as though they're supposed to be relatively short, yeah, is absurd. But I definitely had thought about just how much of a toll we were placing on the environment in our traditional in-person processes, you know, flying for sure, but even, you know, they joke that in Toronto, rush hour is now 24/7, the amount of toxins we were releasing into the atmosphere to get everybody together in the same place at the same time, only for them to spend most of their time in separate rooms as I shuttle back and forth in caucus, just doesn't make much sense when you consider the environments as well. I do want to make sure to let my clients know that when it comes to mediation, I put their interest first. Yep. But there's no harm in putting their interests first and also thinking about the environment if it's not necessary to go about doing things that are going to be damaging. I have found that there has been quite a bit of intrigue in the pledge. And I'm disappointed that you say that there have been some practitioners who have just jumped at the opportunity to go back on planes and everything, because I think that there is a legitimate cause there that we as practitioners can truly do something about and make a difference with.
It's, I suspect, a minority that have resiled from their original position, but a noticeable minority. But yeah, but thank you for that, Mark. Colm?
I think it's a really good idea, except that there are benefits for sure for the environment for doing things online, but there's also detriment in terms of server farms and use of energy. So it's not Absolutely. Quite an either or situation, but I agree with Mark. I mean, it was quite common to get a fax of a mediation brief, still fax, and then an email of it. And then you get a hard copy of the mediation. We've done away with all that. So that's great. So I think we have saved a bunch of trees, and I think we badly need to save a bunch of trees. So I think from that perspective, and traffic and travel and all those, it makes sense. And I think people recognize that. I'm not sure it's really high up there. I suspect another year or so it will be, for many reasons, including our climate change.
Yeah. Well, the point you make also, Colm, is one that is on the Green Pledge website, which is the recognition that working digitally is not climate neutral. Server farms particularly, I know when I used to talk to my students about the ethics of the internet and digital life, and say, well, you use the cloud, where is the cloud? And they'd point wistfully somewhere up there. So one, know what you've got is it was a server farm the size of Kansas using an awful lot of power. A lot of that now is solar powered, but nevertheless, it's not energy neutral. Second part of the question, though, and, which is the adoption of digital methodology. I mean, ODR, we've largely been talking about in terms of taking our practices online. But do you have a sense of or information about where the use of digital technologies in Canada across the various provinces is enhancing access to justice? And this is not just migrating online, but also using artificial intelligence, other digital aids. Have you a sense of where we're up to in that, on that?
Well, I mean, maybe I'll comment on that, given Mark's position, but we are seeing the use of technology in really effective ways. I mean, in some ways, Canada has been a leader in that with the Civil Resolution Tribunal in British Columbia, basically replacing small claims court. It started out with condo strata disputes and then went into insurance and into other things. So, and what's amazing about it is that it has a 70-80% satisfaction rate with users because it was designed for the users. In Ontario, we have the Condominium Authority Tribunal, which is a wee bit different because it's completely online. But it is interesting that both of them started off with condo strata disputes, which are fairly complex disputes, although they may not appear to be, and involve, ongoing relationships often. People who live in the condominium have to continue to live there. And so those things, and I think just the general, familiarity and ease of use with technology is helping. Our courts, as I suspect most courts in the Western world, are really in a bad way. They are, damaged in terms of extremely long waiting lists now. They already had those. The problem and an access to justice issue is the tribunals were designed for end users, the people who are in disputes, not their professional advisors. And the tribunals being asynchronous and all kinds of other neat stuff does give access to justice for the users, but has received some pushback from some lawyers, because they find it hard to fit it into the traditional model of lawyering and billing and all those things. But I think the tribunals are where we're going to see the development of it. And many people don't realize how huge the tribunal system is. Mm-hmm. So I think that's where we'll see it used. And again, I think it's because the focus is not on the professional user. I mean, when I used to teach ADR, I would say to my students, take a doctor from 20 years ago and put them in an operating theater today, and they'd be stunned, the technology. Take a lawyer from 100 years ago, put them in a court, and they'd be very familiar with it. Yep. And I think that kind of makes it very difficult to move ahead, because that's a system that is designed for the professional users, not the end users. And that's where the use of technology and online processes, I think, has tremendous potential, and we're beginning to see attention being paid to it. As for AI in Canada, well, AI in Canada is much like AI everywhere. If everyone talking about it and writing about it was doing it, we'd be miles ahead, or not. In Canada, there is one big project, and Colin Rule's involved with it at Queen's University, where they're getting a dump of data from insurance companies and are designing systems around that. But that's ahead of the curve. And then, of course, I understand, I think your next podcast, your guest there is really involved in that side of it at the University of Montreal. So that should be good for you from that point of view. So I think that's the fundamental difference. And so we have to get professionals around that. And I think it's beginning. And so ODR online processes have great potential. but they won't be driven by the court system.
Yeah.
They'll be driven, at least I think, in Canada by the tribunal system.
How interesting. Yeah. Mark?
Well, I think that these traditional processes here have been very cost prohibitive when it comes to offering access to justice. There's been a series of research that has taken place in our area for the past 15, 20 years that have essentially declared that there is an access to justice crisis. And just the cost of legal representation, the amount of time that it takes to go through these processes, if somebody, you know, whether they have the choice to or are forced to proceed without legal representation, the toll that it takes on people in terms of opportunity costs and stress of trying to go through these processes unrepresented, it's very clearly not working. Mm-hmm. But there's also been quite a bit said about how these traditional billing models of lawyers and law firms has to change. In certain cases, in the Civil Resolution Tribunal in British Columbia, you're not allowed to participate with legal representation in a process. So what happens is you get your legal advice behind the scenes in terms of coaching, in terms of preparation and expectation management. Really, what we're also seeing with the embrace of asynchronous processes is some ethical dilemmas for lawyers when it comes to billing practices traditionally. For example, if you have a lawyer participating as a representative in a live mediation that takes place for 3 hours, how much time are they going to bill you for? But if you divide that 3-hour mediation over the course of 2 weeks in a series of stints, it can raise some ethical dilemmas as to just how much you bill for, particularly if you're facing very high billing targets and all kinds of stresses and expectations as far as that goes. There's opportunities there. And there's also the argument around the time that it takes for somebody to gear up to participate in an asynchronous process as opposed to all in one go in terms of becoming familiar with the file and the key aspects there. So we are seeing some changes here. Those ethical dilemmas do give rise to some questions as to if the asynchronous processes end up increasing the cost of representation that I expect that we're going to have to iron out because there are people who for decades here were not able to access the justice system because the cost of doing it was so prohibitive. And they're now able to at lower cost options at these tribunals. The legal sector is going to have to adapt to realize that there are opportunities where you are able to get involved and do some billing on a file that's not going to be a five-figure billing every time you have a client.
Yeah.
I think if I could just add to that, if it's okay, Ian. I am hopeful that we're moving the right way. I think the impact of COVID, an unintended consequence, was to make lawyers more familiar with technology. Because quite frankly, lawyers have been absent from the discussions around technology, whether in legal field or in the ADR field. And I think this is making lawyers more aware. And as they see the benefits, and again, I think younger lawyers more so because they're so used to it, I think we'll see that trickle down. Although I don't see the courts changing dramatically, you know, for a long time, but I do see there's hope in that. I mean, most lawyers are really concerned about doing the best job for their clients. So I think now they've realized that technology can be an ally in that, that it's another tool. It's not something that, you know, they don't want to touch. And I think that's really hopeful. And I think that has come out of the COVID crisis.
Sure. I'm just thinking at the beginning of the COVID crisis, our Chief Justice here commented that the courts had to go online, the court business had to continue except for jury trials, which that couldn't be managed. But she has maintained a view that the court, I mean, really arguing for one side of Richard Susskind's question as to whether the courts are a location or a service, very much the view here is that the courts are a location. And what you're suggesting is that the service now is actually going to be provided more effectively by tribunals. That's not to argue against the court as a location, as a kind of part of the sort of architecture of democracy, I suppose. I haven't had a look at Richard Susskind's third edition of his book about tomorrow's lawyers, but he would certainly have something to say about, as you do, Mark, about the structure of lawyering practice, which is geared around a particular way of working and way of billing, which will need to change. And you probably have in Canada, as we do here, the rise of the self-represented litigant. who is of necessity forced upon their own devices in the courts and tribunals, which of course is causing issues for admin staff and for the courts themselves in ways in which they are forced to help in going against the adversarial model, where it's not the role of the judge to help the helpless client. So there's a whole, not just an ODR, not just a pandemic, there's a concatenation of circumstances which say that things are coming to a head and will need to change. But now, take us in a slightly different direction with a twofold question, something that you've both touched on in relation to the access to justice. There's also an access to technology issue, and something you alluded to before, Colm, talking about the problems with technology. Not everybody here, and certainly not everybody in Canada, I imagine, has access to suitable technology. Has that been an issue?
For me, I think it depends on what you consider to be suitable technology. If you consider suitable technology to be participating in a video conference with seamless internet and a perfect background, then no. But I think we found, and as Colin Rule's research has shown, that that's a starting point for a lot of people. But in fact, we find that the most dynamic ODR methods are those that incorporate things such as text, which are fairly rudimentary and very accessible in our area.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see that as the problem it was a few years ago. More public access. I mean, our internet, with all due respect to the providers, is very expensive, as are our phones, our mobile phones. And so I think that's as much an issue of, the cost. We've seen the digital divide, if that's still there, in different ways. I mean, I think one part of it that's gone pretty much, and that's my experience in mediation, I have no data to support that, is the idea if you're older, you're not going to use technology. And the oldest person that I've had in a mediation was even older than me, and she was 94. And her lawyer didn't want her to, yeah, just a wee bit. Her lawyer didn't want her to do it, said, no, that's not going to work. And she insisted. Right? She said, no, I speak to my grandkids and my great-grandkids on video. I know what I'm doing. But where ODR came in really well there, and again, maybe an access through technology, is instead of having a half-day mediation, we split it in two, which you can do. So there's some issues around technology, and we see that in education as well, where there's a presumption that children will have access to technology that may not be there. But I don't see it as great a problem as it was pre-COVID. I'm completely wrong, of course. That's just my perspective. Well, maybe it's just based on sample I see.
Colin, but what you've been saying for years is that it becomes a way of life, the use of technology. If we're using it for our banking, if we're using it for our shopping, if we're using it for dating, it only makes sense then that that's where we go to resolve our disputes. And I think that that's what we're talking about, is integrating the types of technologies and the platforms that people are already comfortable with and already using, as opposed to introducing them to a foreign concept. And courts as a location was very soon, if it's not already, going to be a foreign concept to several generations going forward.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I guess the pandemic also showed in the educational context that you alluded to, Colm, is that as soon as schools were forced to work remotely, the question arose as to whether, certainly here in New Zealand and some of the more remote communities, which may be more Indigenous communities as well, the infrastructure wasn't there or wasn't as reliable. They might be working on 2G or 3G at best, not 4 or 5. And your point also, Colm, is the access is expensive. One of our major providers, our telecom providers, actually provided low-cost modems to a number of those areas to allow them access. So they scored a number of brownie points that way. But most people will have access to some sort of telephone device. It doesn't have to be a high-end computer, does it? But There's two parts that one is the access in terms of ownership of or being able to get hold of these technologies, but then once you're confronted with them, knowing what to do with them. because that's also part of where the divide comes in. And some of the stories we heard also during lockdown were of parents taking their kids to sit on the doorstep outside the local library to patch into the library's Wi-Fi and the streetlights to be up for the kids to be able to do their homework. Those are kind of classic hard luck stories, but they're ones we need to pay attention to in thinking of the access to justice, particularly if, as you say, Mark, we're almost being forced into a digital age. I don't know what it's like in various parts of Canada, but as banks close, as post offices close, people are forced into online uses of those services. It's a great frustration when the bloody things don't work. But
but there's one piece on that, Ian, that I'd like to bring up. And I remember when I launched online services and tried to have a bit of a marketing campaign at the big, 2015. I had a couple of people take interest, but not a large number. And those who did saw it as a novelty, not having to have a client fly from halfway across the country to participate in a mediation, some scheduling concerns, so maybe we can mediate at a unique time. But those who embraced it liked technology and almost had an expectation of perfection that it would operate flawlessly. And one of the things that we've found is because it was forced upon people during the pandemic, the lack of perfection humanized the process. It's become commonplace for somebody to forget to unmute themselves, for them to have a pet crash their meeting. And yes, traditionally that was viewed as being exceptionally unprofessional. But when you look at ODR historically being complained about as being something that's a cold process, these imperfections show that it's more human and allow us in the mediation context to delve into that human side and that personal side of relationships. One of the things that I've found since my mediation practice has really exploded online is I've seen the inside of more clients' homes and more lawyers' offices than I ever would have for decades previously. Yeah. That allows us in a different way, but it allows us to be able to overcome some of those hurdles and make it more personal, which is essential in a lot of the mediations that I conduct.
Yeah. It allows your voyeuristic tendencies as well, doesn't it, Mark? What's that book you've got on your shelves up there?
I think outside the box. What are you reading?
You can see on the shelves here.
Just on the technology side for a moment. I mean, we have to keep in mind, when you and I were undergraduates, which isn't yesterday, Mark's a bit younger than us, computers were huge and didn't do much. Now you have more power.
I had computers
on your phone
when I was an undergraduate at home.
They basically, now you have the phone, right? So the phone's great. But what it brought out, I think, is when we suddenly flipped into using Zoom, right? Mm. People were horrified. And they were horrified for a couple of reasons. One is because we've become complacent in terms of taking technology out of a box and turning it on. So the idea of settings suddenly became a huge issue. And the other one, and I think it feeds into what Mark says, a bit less strict, was, the argument, oh my God, I can't do this because it's not private, it's not confidential, people can listen in. And, my stock answer to that would be, and it came from many people, would be, do you send email? People would say, yeah. Do you attach documents? Yeah. I said, so why don't you send a postcard and why are you worried about this? And so I think people saw it in a different way. Not only do they have to use it, but they saw it was much more flexible. And I think there has been, a really positive move towards providing clients with many options in person, what we're now calling ODR, to a much different system down the road.
Certainly, it requires us to pay attention. I mean, your comment, Mark, about seeing inside people's houses, and there's a sense of both the intimacy and the separation of knowing you're over there. I was just having a conversation yesterday with a colleague who works in the digital field and in mediation, who said that one of her colleagues had made the mistake of not paying attention to a protection order which was involved between a couple in a mediation. A protection order is one of the first things you look at in a family case if they're going to be in the same building. These people were not in the same building. They were in Zoom rooms, but nevertheless, the protection order still applies, because of the possibility of online abuse. So we still pay attention to those details of connection.
We have to remember that ODR doesn't exist in a vacuum, that while in the mid-90s, it started with this great idea of being able to bring people together that were doing business an ocean apart. In Canada, as Colm said, with both the Civil Resolution Tribunal and the Canadian Condominium Authority Tribunal focusing on condominium disputes, there are situations where you could have a mediation with people through Zoom, and right after the mediation, they're sharing an elevator with one another. You need to have the screening in place and be aware that it's not only going to exist online. I think that's a really important aspect as we look forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And aware of the risks of what people might be able to pick up from the Zoom room by way of information about the other party. So this is something that when I had my earlier conversation with Leah Wing, she's very strong on the ethics issues, and you know, we're aware of the ethics issues when we do face-to-face regular mediation, regular work, but we carry those over and probably more of them into the online setting.
I had a couple of circumstances where there was concern around the use of virtual backgrounds and the in a video type mediation, and the concern of, you know, what about the confidentiality? Who else is there? And at the same time, I had a couple of clients who were doing things like participating in a video mediation from their car or their closet or their bathroom. And it's like you want them to be able to preserve some dignity as well, right? So there's a number of different factors there that never would present themselves in a traditional in-person mediation that we need to keep in mind for sure.
Yeah. There's a kind of relaxation that goes with that too, isn't it? I remember having a conversation just last year with somebody who said, "Excuse me, you know, I'm in my car. It's okay. I'm being driven," but the video kept cutting in and out, and it didn't make for a great podcast, I must say. but it was probably the only way I could actually pin this person down.
On the ethics side of it, I think when we started having to use video conferencing with the lockdowns, I think a lot of ADR organizations scrambled to put out guidelines, and some of them are quite good. I think now, you know, organizations like iCoder are setting standards and for training and for everything else. And I think we're going to see more of that. And hopefully people will produce a standard that makes sense to the users. As much as anything else, because there's that ambiguity in every standard and every guideline. I mean, we have to be careful about that. But I think, you know, there was some effort to maintain the rules of conduct, professional conduct that are in the in-person environment, try and bring it, some of it anyway, into the online environment. And I think it was done quite well. I know the ADR Institute of Canada and ADR Institute of Ontario, actually, Mark and I were working on that, produce guidelines for, you know, online mediation, online arbitration. And I think they've worked fairly well, but I expect we'll see more focus on that area, on the ethics, which we haven't. I mean, it's only recently we've had the first books on even ethics in ADR, never mind going into ODR. Exactly. Articles, yes, but not very much else.
Yeah. And what I'm liking also, Colm, is again, your emphasis on the interests of the end user, which is a shift in our thinking about justice generally, which takes me to really sort of one last thing I'd like to deal with, because I'm just looking at my watch and we may need to wrap up in a minute or two. But one group of end users, certainly an issue in here, and I imagine in multicultural Canada, it is also the commitment of ODR providers, ODR services, to take account of the voice of Indigenous parties. Is there work being done in that area?
In Canada in general, there's been a recognition that this country has failed its Indigenous people for generations. So there has been quite a bit of a movement to do everything that we possibly can to try to while we'll never be able to fully make it right, to try to reverse some of those injustices. And when it comes to online, the Indigenous communities are able to have quite a voice and able to break down a lot of the systemic barriers and find platforms to be able to get audiences that they traditionally have not been able to have on these lands. So I do think that there is a role when it comes to dispute resolution and online systems to embrace some of the Indigenous ways of doing things, restorative processes and the like. But they're just like there are in converting other types of dispute resolution processes online, there are certainly some hurdles and challenges, particularly because we can't replicate in person online. There are going to be differences. And yeah, one of the challenges that we've had here is there are some who have always put those in-person processes on a pedestal and try to replicate them online instead of overcoming the obstacles that exist and the challenges that exist in traditional online processes and overcome them through technology. But I'm certainly hopeful. I think that there is a role for the technology to assist Indigenous communities to have the voice that they've needed for so long here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Mark's right. Mark's been modest. I mean, he knows a lot about this. He ran one of the first programs, a course in the summer on dispute resolution, focused on Indigenous issues, which was fantastic. I took it for something to do, and I'm glad I did. But, you know, we're not really focusing on those kind of issues to the degree we need to. And that's coming up in training as well. We train with one of our colleagues, Richard Moore, is a well-known trainer and mediator in Ottawa. And traditionally in his in-person mediation training, he's, you know, an advanced course and basic course, he would have a circle in the advanced course and bring in a circle keeper from one of the local Indigenous groups. So the first time we ran it online, it was, are we going to do this or not? And we had different opinions from different communities. In fact, we did run it. And in fact, it was incredibly powerful. Different, you know, similar, but not the same, which is kind of the mantra we use about online dispute resolution. Yeah. I think the issues are coming up. I don't think we're paying enough attention to many of the ethical and cultural issues around ODR. And that's a big problem in, you know, communities like, well, in countries like Canada that are really, you know, multi-ethnic, multi-everything. But I think we have to, walk a wee bit more before we're able to speed it up a bit. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, maybe we'll do that as we transition from which is a transition period, mm-hmm, into more integrated ODR platforms. Mm-hmm.
And he said, I was thinking about this too, again, the same conversation I was having yesterday and late last year with colleagues about the design of ODR processes by Indigenous Maori. And there's an interesting problem with the preposition, design by or design for. Mm-hmm. And I put out a call to my ODR colleagues saying, is there anyone out there who knows whether there are examples of design by Indigenous people? And I got replies which said, yeah, we're designing for. And
yeah, that's been a big problem here in so many aspects of handling issues, mm-hmm, with Indigenous people. They are the ones who have the understanding of what's needed and the ability to be able to craft what will be success. Canada has gotten itself in a lot of trouble with our Indigenous communities. They're not ours, but by calling them our Indigenous communities, they have to stand on their own. They have to be able to speak for themselves. We cannot, as non-Indigenous people, come up with the solutions. They have to be a part of it for those solutions to be sustainable.
Right.
And yeah, from an ADR point of view, that makes sense. Self-determination is one of the keys to what we do in mediation.
Where we came in, isn't it?
Yeah.
50 and years
there
ago.
There is a real push towards diversity in ADR in Ontario and in other provinces, which is great to see because traditionally there hasn't.
Yeah.
You know, I think it just really fits in.
Well, that's kind of a hopeful note on which to draw this to a close, because I'm looking at the time, and I've taken you over the time that I said I would. But, Mom and Mark, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much for taking the time to join this podcast series. And I look forward to hearing this up online. And I actually look forward to keeping in further contact. Colm, we go back 20 years. Mark, we go back 20 days. But yeah, this is the start of something beautiful, I'm sure. So I'll end the recording in a second, but do please stay online just for a few moments. But thank you so much for your time. It's been good to talk to you.
Thank you so much for having us.
an ending to this from my perspective. I'll fall back on an old Irish saying, which is, it's a long road that has no turning. And I think we're in the turning in the road moment.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Thank you.
Thanks.
Take care.
This podcast has been brought to you by iCoder, the International Council for Online Dispute Resolution. To learn more about iCoder or to become a supporting member, please visit our website at icodr.org.